Hey, everyone. I want to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Copper. Copper is an institutional custodian in crypto and provider of prime services. They're also one of my favorite companies in the space. So thank you very much to Copper for making this episode possible. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the show. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety-first L2, accelerating the transition to an on-chain financial system. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the episode. But for now, on with the program. All right, everyone. Welcome back to another weekly round of On the Margin. Today, I'm joined by my trusty co-host, Quinn Thompson. We've shed the dead weight. Tyler's not with us this
week. We'll have to see what the reviews are like after this one, and it might have to make it permanent.
Yeah, I know. Tyler, exposing your neck there, buddy. No, he's got his 40th out in Vegas. So we hope wherever you are, Tyler, you're having fun and appropriately hungover. For your 40 years of age, but
showing his age.
Exactly. But yeah, but Quinn, for listeners, Quinn and I have actually been hanging out a good amount in person recently because we just had, we're coming off DAS London. So we're going to be this 3 days, big institutional conference. We had like 1700 people there. We had to cap it. A lot of energy out here. Definitely. We've been doing London conferences for like 4 years now. Definitely the most energy we've ever seen by an extremely wide margin. But what do you think, Quinn?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I think the last London one I went to was DAS 21. Was it October 2021? And funny enough, that was obviously like raging bull market or near the end of it. And I remember so many of the conversations being like that meme on Twitter, which is the TradFi guy holding his coffee and saying, "Oh, we're just poking around. You know, we don't invest. We're just, you know, Bitcoin, not blockchain, or blockchain, not Bitcoin," whatever that old saying was that people had. And it was very like TradFi outside looking in. This one felt, I mean, so like Franklin Templeton, GoldenTree, KKR. I mean, it was just it was just very legitimized and everyone was very serious. There's obviously your crypto natives as well, but I mean, it is more of an institutional conference than some of the others, but I felt it was very, yeah, nothing like over the top euphoric and a lot of people, you know, building and building things for the institutions that need it, whether it's trading infrastructure, custody. I walked away very positive. And you guys always put on a good event. So
thanks, buddy. For folks who weren't able to attend, we're going to air some of the panels. There was a great one, on the Spot Bitcoin ETF. There are a couple trading panels that were super interesting. I actually hosted one. It's a little bit more on the technical side with the folks from Copper, DRW, Hashnote on just collateral mobility, capital efficiency and yield, which I thought was a really interesting panel. I guess some takeaways from the conference overall. Was that I really think that Europe is going to be an increasingly important market for crypto. I think that everything that the SEC and various regulatory bodies have done in the US post FTX collapse, this sort of crackdown and I think just pretty openly hostile environment, has actually pushed some amount of investment and entrepreneurial activity permanently out of the US. So Asia is obviously very hot, but I think Europe, for really the first time since we've been hosting these conferences, like, I think they're the beneficiary of everything that's been going on in the US. And there's a new regulatory framework out here, MiCA, which there are some issues with, but ultimately it's going to provide at least some clarity for these large companies that want to have a clear framework and rules and guidelines and all that stuff to operate out here. So I would expect the UK, Europe in general, to keep growing in terms of market. I also think, you know, we can get into this because there was a little bit of an announcement from BlackRock this week about this new product that they launched on Ethereum, this $100 million sort of like money market-like fund. But this tokenization stuff that Larry Fink's been talking about on CNBC is not just hot air. 100%, everyone was very excited about the Bitcoin spot ETFs. But, you know, one of the big questions everyone was asking is like, okay, what's next? And it feels like tokenization is this thing, like you and I have been hearing about this for years, right? And it's always like, okay, like when is this tokenization thing actually going to end up happening? But it feels like it's right around the corner, actually, for the first time in a pretty real way. So
yeah, I think everyone we've been talking about this on the pod for a while, like that narrative of a Bitcoin led or Bitcoin only the cycle, and how it always comes up at this time in the environment right around all time highs. And I mean, BlackRock just launched a tokenized, you know, product on Ethereum less than 2 months after, or about 2 months after their ETF launch. So we have 9 more months left of the year. So if we keep that cadence, we get about 4 more product launches. And, you know, not that that will continue, but I think it shows they're serious and they're actively looking. You know, you have to imagine there's many other things in the pipe for them.
100%. 100%. So yeah, I guess honestly, probably going to be, one of the last things that we talked about is just like the cycle dynamics. There's a really great panel with, Avi and Jonah from 1000X, one of the BlockRock's, podcasts. That was a ton of fun. I think we'll air that on this feed as well. But you can listen to it on the 1000X feed on Empire. But honestly, Avi had some really great observations about how this cycle is different a little bit, maybe from past cycles. You know, he sort of made this point that there's a barbell of, he said something that I agreed with, which is, I don't think there's much like net new retail coming into this space yet. It just like really doesn't feel like that to me. And that sort of explains why there's this barbell in terms of performance, like Bitcoin doing really well, because that's actually the spot ETF flows that are driving that, and like meme coins, because that's like the crypto natives that just understand the things that are going to go up. They're skipping right to the end. They've seen this movie before. And it feels like very PvP though on the meme coin side of things, but that's why those two things are doing well. And there's this just like hole in the middle, right? So I thought that was a really strong observation as well. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, those guys are fun. I love Joan. You know, Avi's like the risk taker, and Jonah's always reeling back in. And he reminds me more of like some of the credit people we used to work with. But yeah, that was a really fun panel. People were excited. I was sitting next to Yano, and there's some suits next to us, and people were furiously jotting down notes. I loved it. It's like these older like TradFi guys taking notes from, you know, Avi's like talking about shit coins on stage. It was hilarious.
That's so funny, man. That makes me happy.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Copper. Copper is an institutional custodian and provider of prime services within digital assets. Today, what I want to talk to you specifically about is Clearloop. Clearloop is a solution from Copper, which to me solves one of the biggest problems for market makers, high frequency traders, hedge funds within digital assets. You know the exquisite pain of what I call the pre-funding problem. So if you want to take advantage of arbitrages that pop up across different exchanges, or you just have a trading strategy which requires you to be active on multiple different centralized exchanges, you have to pre-fund your account at each one of those exchanges. Now, this is not ideal for a whole bunch of reasons. One, you have to take counterparty risk from those exchanges, which, as we saw this last year, can have major consequences. Two, it's capital inefficient. You have a whole bunch of assets spread out that most of them are not doing anything most of the time. And three, it's just not great from a workflow standpoint, and it creates administrative overhead. So enter Clearloop. Clearloop is the secure MPC custody solution provided by Copper. The way that it works is you deposit your assets into this MPC solution, which is owned and operated by you. Clearloop syncs up with a whole bunch of your favorite exchanges, and then you can trade securely from Clearloop itself while not taking any counterparty exchange risk with any of these exchanges. And it's a super easy and nice UX. Now, Clearloop is trusted by the likes of Flow Traders, Brevan Howard, Nickel, some of the best in the business. But the coup de grace is, in the extreme edge case that one of these exchanges were to go bankrupt, they have a very clever trust structure which segregates your assets and keeps you completely protected. So click the link at the bottom of this episode, especially if you're a hedge fund and market maker and you want to learn more. Or better yet, Dimitri, the CEO, is actually going to be in person on a panel hosted by yours truly at Digital Asset Summit. So DAS London, that's March 18th to the 20th in London. So you should definitely click the link at the bottom of this episode, give your boy some credit, but also even better, come to DAS London and hear from Dimitri himself. All right. Cheers, everyone. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety first layer 2 that is accelerating the transition to the on-chain financial system. Now, I know we're all very excited about tokenization. Larry Fink certainly is. He's on CNBC talking about it all the time. And I know we're all very excited about L2s. Here's the problem, though. If we want L2s to onboard the financial system, there's a lot of stuff that we still need, and Kinto is basically rolling out solutions for that. So one, it features user-owned KYC, which is just table stakes for our regulated friends. And if we want the institutional capital to come in, Kinto offers a really good solution for that. They also have native account abstraction that solves some of the largest problems with onboarding in terms of security and user experience today, which is still very confusing. So if we want to bring more folks onto Ethereum, Kinto is the way to do that. And if you believe in this on-chain financial system and you actually want to get more active in Kinto and become a founding member, you should join their launch program, which is Engine. That's E-N-G-N. You can see a link in the show notes. So if you're a part of that, you can do things like participate in Kinto governance, the launch ceremony, you can priority access to product launches on Kinto. You get reduced fees and unique discounts on products launch on Kinto. So overall, if you want to be a part of Kinto and the mission that they have, I would go click the link, join the Engine program, and thank me later.
All right, let's move past the conference. I want to get your view on the FOMC. So we had an FOMC this week. Jay Powell, I gave what I thought was a pretty dovish FOMC. It looks like the markets interpreted that crypto caught a bid, stocks caught a bid, and I think a lot of, I mean, I know you took a bunch of notes, so maybe I'll just turn it over to you, but I think basically what the market was reacting to, there was a specific clip where he addressed inflation and his thoughts about inflation picking back up. And basically, to paraphrase what Chair Powell said, is that, look, we always assumed that this was going to be bumpy. We're not reading overly much into the January and February CPI numbers. Basically, we expected this to happen. And in his mind, he still thinks that inflation is headed lower, which is obviously bullish if you're hoping for rate cuts later this year. But what were some of your takeaways?
Yeah, I think... So the market obviously at the start of the year had like six cuts priced in, and the Fed was, you know, much lower, more like three. And there, people were confused going into this meeting, I would say over the last few months, that the market's expectations corrected from six to the two to three-ish, and risk assets didn't budge, right? So I think a lot of that going into this meeting was a stronger than expected economy. We saw the Fed projections, you know, and everybody over the last quarter revised their estimations of GDP growth higher. So it makes sense that, you know, risk assets would do okay while the number of rate cuts is coming in due to the strong economy. I think to summarize it for me, this reporter from the AP had a good question, which he called out the fact that the committee has these three cuts as their median priced in. They have core PCE at 2.6% as Q4 expected reading, and we're sitting at 2.8 today. So, you know, his question was, what more do you need to see moving that direction? If you think it's going to be 0.2% lower in 9 months, and you saying you need to see more, what is that? And that tells, and Powell's answer was, you know, it was vague, obviously, but it tells me they don't actually need to see it move much lower. I think it's just that they need to see it not move higher. And that's what I took away from his, you know, bumps interpretation, which is if you look at where their Q4 projections are paired with where we're at in those readings, so you have, they estimate Q4 2024, we're going to have 2.1% GDP growth, 4% unemployment, 2.4% PCE, and 2.6% core PCE. Right now, we're sitting at GDP 3.2, unemployment 3.9. So I think that's one to call out. It bottomed at 3.5 last year. We're just below, you know, any time below the reading. We have PCE at 2.4, which is for in Jan. We'll wait to see Feb's end of this month, which is at their expectations. And then we have core PCE at 2.8. Powell said that's what he estimates February is to be, which is slightly above their expectations. So they're basically, I think, actually much more concerned about the labor market than commentators are talking about. Because what that tells me is we're basically at the inflation, what they expect for the end of the year. You know, that he kept emphasizing over time, we'll get it down to two. You know, his expectations for next year's PCE is 2.2. So he really means, like, we're not trying to like slam inflation home this year and not even next year to 2%. So I think that, but what he, I think what they don't want is unemployment creeping up. And so I actually, oftentimes you want to fade, you know, the initial moves we saw a lot of kind of the unprofitable tech rallying post FOMC, things like that. But I thought it was very bullish. And then so many times, I think it was two or three, he commented on, you know, they're committed to bringing inflation down. But then he included multiple immediate hedges right after that said, well, if the labor market was weaker than expected, that could induce us quicker. And so many times he emphasized economic growth over inflation to two. And I kind of think that the committee's probably looking around, seeing inflation, you know, 2.5 to 3.5 and growth strong, the market's cooperating and thinking, this is fine. You know, they can't, they're never like, what would you expect them to do if they were going to be okay with this? They're not going to go out and say their target is now 3% because then the market is going to reprice. So, and then the last part to me that was, again, really dovish was his point about balance sheet runoff lowering. So he noted after the RRP is drained, you know, at zero or somewhere close to zero, which I'm going to take his word for it. He's inside the ball game here. He pointed out the dollar for dollar lowering of banking reserves and that they do not want to get reserves to the lowest possible level. They think they're at abundant now, but they want to settle at ample, which is they're not trying to scrape it down to zero on the banking reserve side. So again, just another area that they're like very conscious of liquidity in the system. And by pointing out, you know, that's going to run off, the QT is going to taper sooner or fairly soon was his words. Again, something else that I thought bolstering liquidity. So I do take it kind of what the market's reaction was, and you know, we maybe cool off a day or two because it was obviously a very strong reaction following, but I have a hard time getting bearish from that.
Yeah, I think both really good points. And you know, in terms of the supply dynamic of, I mean, the tapering for QT, I mean, basically if they're lowering the amount of QT that the Fed is doing on a monthly basis, that's just fewer bonds for the private market, you know, to absorb. And yeah, I mean, honestly, that I guess he sort of included this little caveat that might actually push QT out. They might have to do it for longer, but I mean, that's such a long period of time away. I'm not really sure if the market cares about that much, and more the immediate impact is the more important one there. So completely agree with you on that.
I mean, we're sitting here with the TGAs at about 700 to 800 billion, I believe. The RRP is still, you know, between 400 and 500. And they're going to be reducing runoff from 95 to pick a number between 50 and 70. So we're talking maybe 1.5 billion of call it room in liquidity for the Fed and Treasury to maneuver here before year end, election year. Seems pretty supportive.
Yeah. So I guess that sort of, if you don't think that inflation is moving back up and the amount of duration that's going into the market is going down, all sequel, you'd expect yields to stay at least pat, if not go lower from here, which is just bullish asset prices. And I think you're also very right to, you know, comment on the yield markets or on the labor market as well, rather. Like we knew, like if you rewind the clock back to 2021, like Powell was paying an enormous amount of attention to this, and a lot of the flack that the Fed has gotten, like, hey, why'd you have your foot on the gas so hard when it comes to QE? Like, you know, market participants were all looking at like the price of stocks, to be honest, and things like that. But the Fed, they are really looking at these very specific measures of inflation, and they're looking at the labor market because they have a dual mandate. And you can argue that was a mistake. The Fed kept buying as many bonds as they did back then. But, you know, we know that they pay a lot of attention to the labor market. He brought up a couple of different statistics that he's paying attention to that shows that the labor market might be weakening. Does it feel anecdotally to you like the labor market is weak, I guess? I'm not sure. It's definitely not as tight as it was. I mean, there was a period in 21, 22 where it was just nuts. It feels all is equal, pretty balanced. I guess anecdotally, there are fewer times like I'll go to a restaurant and, you know, they're like, oh, we are only open for these hours because we just couldn't find workers. Like that's not really happening so much anymore. It actually feels pretty balanced from my standpoint, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think it is. I just think the economy is quite strong. I mean, you go to the airports, you're seeing these daily flying attendance numbers. They're huge. What another point that he actually brought up, which I I've kind of mentioned was the immigration side. He pointed to some of this labor supply balance coming more intact due to immigration, which the, if you go, we don't need to get into it now, but you look at the immigration numbers, or at least the border crossing numbers, they're actually staggering. Over the last 3 years, the number of encounters on the southern border has basically been close to equal the total number of unemployed people in the workforce in the US over the last 3 years. And this is a, I mean, it leads into why I think Trump's going to win, because these are ultimately, it's this dichotomy of like, you know, those are lower and middle income jobs. And it's also why inflation isn't going away, because there is this so much supply of labor coming in. So yeah, I think it's strong. The thing that I'm watching most closely is the effects that this dovishness and future easing of policy, both in the US and globally, we saw the Swiss with their surprise rate cut, is going to have on commodities. Commodities have been very strong, and eventually, it's not been the reaction immediately, but eventually, you know, that's inflationary and puts pressure on the long end yield. So while short end rates are coming down, or should be coming down fairly soon, the biggest risk to me here is if we do get some of this inflationary stuff getting out of hand on the commodity side, on services, housing, you know, that could put pressure on the long end bond yields, yeah, and risk.
So there's a story that sort of flew a little bit under the radar, but saw that the US came out and said that they want to refill the SPR by end of year. So that's some 270 million barrels of oil that they're going to need to buy between now and then. And if folks remember, I think it was last year that the SPR, Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the US, they were selling for a while, and there, you could speculate as to why that is. I think it was basically just to try to push the price of oil down when it was stoking inflation fears. But now you look, you can see, I mean, oil's back above $80 a barrel. Looks like it's climbing. And you can actually look at the price of oil superimposed over inflation expectations. And as oil goes up, inflation expectations also tend to rise. So that was just kind of an interesting, I don't know. I don't really see how they're gonna buy all that oil and not push the price up at all. Clearly, you know, the selling of the SPR moved the market, so I don't see why refilling it wouldn't have the exact opposite effect. But
yeah, they're not gonna do it. They're absolutely not gonna do it. Election year, that
yeah, it's crazy.
There's zero chance. They're gonna drop that on Trump or Biden, like Biden's, you know, his last term. Or it doesn't matter, re-election. There's no chance that would put a kind of like, you have to, if you're Powell and Yellen, both of them are like, absolutely not, we're not doing this. So that would just really negatively affect their efforts.
It would be absolutely bananas,
especially right now with, like, you look across the whole complex of commodities, copper, gold, silver, the more meme-y one, cocoa, everything's kind of looking pretty strong, potentially breaking out. So that's their biggest fear for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about what happened with the Bank of Japan this week. So Bank of Japan, they're at the forefront of this monetary experimentation that we've been all practicing for the last 20 some odd years. And they, you know, the debt to GDP over in Japan is, you know, extremely high. And they've had this policy of, you know, negative interest rates and yield curve control over there for a really long time. And it's been this widowmaker trade in terms of everyone wants to bet that this policy is going to blow up and eventually they're going to have to stop with yield curve control. And so far, I mean, there have been a ton of traders who've lost their shirts betting against JGBs. But it now looks like, you know, for the first time that they're actually moving away from negative rates, which has a massive impact. I mean, Quinn, can you just kind of give us the update about what happened with the Bank of Japan this week and what some of the implications are?
Yeah, basically, and it's been, they use their media outlets in the same way that the Fed uses Nikkei T. They use theirs maybe even better with the prefacing and setting, managing expectations. So there's actually no surprises. If anything, it was maybe people, it was a little more dovish than people thought. People called it a dovish hike. They basically moved the short-term rate from zero to negative one to zero to, or zero to negative 0.1% to zero to positive 0.1%. So not a big move. Again, I was actually kind of like, that's a risk factor, I think, on the horizon, right? If they start getting, I just think about when the end of 21, early 22 was when the Fed started to get more hawkish and people woke up to like, oh, wow, they're serious about raising rates. That was kind of the end of the bull. You have that risk with Japan, and why it matters for the rest of the world is they are a huge purchaser of foreign assets, particularly US assets, stocks, and US treasuries. And so any raising of domestic rates there causes a flow of capital back home where you know the yen is strengthening. They no longer want to hold dollar-based assets, and then their yields are rising, so it makes their fixed income more attractive. But I think that risk is probably overdone once again, because the Bank of Japan's looking at their stock market, which is, you know, making all-time highs, extremely strong, getting a ton of attention globally. And people are appreciating this exit from zero interest rate policy, but it's very tempered. So I actually think the yen probably has more room to weaken here. I think it's actually stimulative, right, for their domestic economy and stock market to have this weaker currency. So I don't think they're trying to rattle too many cages here and go hawkish too quick too soon. I think they see other global central banks starting to get more dovish from previous hiking cycles and view that as cover, most likely. So probably a risk factor eventually, but probably overblown in the near term, and we see continued, you know, just status quo over there.
Yeah. So just to highlight what might be a risk factor, you know, this sort of relationship, like the Japanese institutional investors are some of the largest in the world. And because rates have been negative for so long over there, they have a very positive foreign investment position, right? So they'll park their money in the US stock market or wherever. And then as rates like start to get, you know, domestic investment opportunities start to look good, rates actually turn positive, stock market's doing well, then there could be a risk that they move their money out and basically pull it back into Japan, right? That's kind of the risk factor. But again, just help contextualize that for me, because, you know, it is funny. I understand that it's symbolic here that the negative interest rates have gone, but the actual policy change is so small. Like, is this really impacting investment decisions that much? It's like nothing.
No. Yeah, what I, for listeners, want to pay attention here, I think similar to the US, where, you know, the short end's going to do what the short end does based on the Fed. It's really the long end that matters. I think if you watch the 10s and 30s in Japan on the yield front, it's definitely strong, you know, but that it's not stronger than, it's just kind of implying a strong economy, in my opinion. And you can also watch that 10s, 30s yield curve over there, where their operations tend to stop at the 10 year. They're not manipulating the 30 year as much. So that's a sign of how much upward pressure on rates there actually is. And it's kind of tempered. So yeah, they're not doing anything that hawkish. I think on net, you know, if you think about the US economy growth, maybe peaking in 3Q of last year at this high 8% nominal, and maybe we, you know, trend down to like 3 to 5, and they're inflecting higher. You know, there's some pressure from that, but it's not like it's massive. And that's what we're seeing in the markets. It was kind of a nothing burger.
Yeah. Well, there's a new central bank rule. I mean, relatively new, Ueda. So bold moves for this guy. Respect.
The stock market's loving it. I mean, you know, people are looking at what happened in the US, raised rates to 5%, and it might actually be stimulative with deficits to size. So
if you want a crazy chart to look at, you can look at the like 50 year Nikkei, which is it's this insanely long, just like cup and handle sort of pattern. It peaked back in the 90s and just only recently made new highs for, like, you know, took 30 some years for that to happen. So pretty bananas, actually.
Yeah. And on a real basis, yeah, even worse. But yeah, good for them.
So, you know, you mentioned other central banks in general starting to pivot a little bit more dovish. And something that I think surprised some folks this last week is that we got a little bit of a surprise cut from the Swiss National Bank. So I don't know, can you give us an update, like what happened over there? How did we get the surprise?
Yeah, I wasn't that close to it. I just kind of saw the headlines. Again, it's kind of the similar thing where they cut by 25 down to 150. So it's probably more, you know, symbolic than it is real impactful. You know, it was their first rate cut in 9 years. And again, these things just kind of give cover, I think. Like, no one's watching the Swiss central bank meetings month over month like they are the Fed or BOJ, but these kind of moves in a globally synchronized way are net positive for liquidity and give other banks and regions cover if they want to do that. So you look around, I mean, China's itching to cut, like ease. They're already easing like crazy, but I think they would be easing even more if, you know, it wasn't going to risk their currency falling off a cliff. So you get these areas. It seems like there's a huge impulse to start loosening monetary policy globally. And with the economy still holding up, you know, it doesn't need to be the strongest economy ever to still be supportive for risk assets. So I think things like gold are telling you that. Bitcoin obviously has had a big run and cooling off here, but seems pretty normal course. Stocks are expanding. So anything that's, you know, inflation hedges and priced in nominal terms has been doing well. And I expect that to continue with the easing globally.
Yeah. And, you know, just to remind folks, because I think there's sometimes a popular attitude that the Fed hasn't done enough. Everyone's very concerned about this idea of like stop start inflation. There's been a relatively long hiking cycle. You know, they first started raising rates extremely aggressively in the US in, you know, March of 22. So it's been like 2 years, really. And at some point, it does make sense for them to start cutting rates again, especially if they're not concerned about inflation, right? So the way this Swiss National Bank move was perceived is kind of like front running the ECB and the Fed. And there's been more persistent upward pressure on prices in Europe. So maybe the ECB is a little bit of a laggard there. But yeah, it feels like I'm with you. It feels like the central bankers are all saying, hey, it's time. You know, we've done our hiking cycles and now it's time to let the other shoe drop. So again, all pretty bullish for asset prices writ large. And yeah, you mentioned gold obviously doing very well. I think this is one of the best setups that crypto has seen in just a really long time as well. So definitely bullish crypto. But crypto's down a good amount from its, you know, it had a 20% sell-off, something like that. Total market cap of the space down from over 2.9 trillion down to 2.5 again. Bitcoin trading around 65 off of, I think, the all-time highs of 73. What do you think about that? Is that this just like a leverage flush, really typical thing that happens during bull markets sort of pullback, or what do you think?
Yeah, well, first, OTM listeners hopefully have been getting some good alpha. Was it 3 weeks ago? We said we're going to go parabolic from, that was when we were what, like 60? And we ramped to... Yeah, we ramped up to 74, and last week we were talking about probably time for some caution. I think it's pretty normal course. What's gotten everyone spooked is the ETF flows reversing and really led by Grayscale. And that's the biggest takeaway for me is, despite these large net outflow numbers we've had this week, one, the trend looks to be declining, as in getting smaller net outflows. And two, it's only been GBTC. So we haven't seen a single outflow from the top three or four, IBIT, Fidelity, Invesco, ARK ETFs. So to me, that does tell me it's one-off. We've seen, now yesterday we got this headline around the possibility of it being a Genesis-related sales. They had, I think it was about $4 billion in total at market prices to liquidate. It looks to me like that's what it is. And when I look around and rates are still very benign, you see gold ripping, stocks ripping. I think, you know, similar people are too levered at the top. Price corrects, they get scared, spooked, you know, delever even further, kind of cause some of these cascades. But yeah, overall, the structure looks, I think, pretty healthy as flows are, net outflows are slowing, funding is completely reset. And you need this, right? It felt like markets were a little too easy. The meme coin mania, everything was, it was making money hand over fist. And to me, it's pretty normal course at these all-time highs where you see this churn. You have sellers coming out when we hit all-time highs, taking a breather. And it always takes a little bit, whether you're a couple thousand above, a couple thousand below, to really meaningful breakthrough. And to me, it's no different than previous cycles, actually. So I'm not spooked. I think actually, after selling last week, I view these as pretty good opportunities to get in.
Yeah. So I think maybe just one thing to point out about the ETF net inflows and outflows is I think it would be a mistake to assume that there can never be outflows, right? And, you know, just at a time when everyone is starting to say, and I think there's good arguments to be made that the ETF just, they're a fundamental change in the market structure of crypto writ large. But I also do think like this is around the time when people look at these massive inflows. Yeah, they extrapolate that out permanently into the future. You start to do some crazy price calculations in your head of like where Bitcoin is going. I'm already seeing like lots of very outlandish or what I would consider outlandish price targets for Bitcoin from some very smart people. So, you know, also just keep in the back of your head that, you know, we can't keep having $1 billion inflow days forever. And eventually this is going to be a net outflow story. I don't know if that's a year from now or something like that, but eventually I think it will be. And
yeah, we were starting to see too many fundamental analysis on meme coins on Twitter. And I think that's what tipped the scales.
It's just so funny how accurate those signals are. You know, I like saw this one thread on meme coins, you know, from some investors, like 20 post thread on how meme coins are the future of culture. It's like, yeah, this probably means some sort of local top here. Like, you know, the people just, I don't know. I don't even want to really engage in the meme coin stuff. I think they're fine. But I don't know. You do have an option to not make it your entire personality, either absolutely hating it or loving it and calling it the future of culture, right? You can just say it's a thing. So
yeah, it's silly. The one thing on the flow side for the ETF that I'm trying to understand, people are like, okay, this is going to lead to outflows. It's the ETF actually isn't as good as people think. But I can't name a more fickle short-term horizon investor than the average crypto investor. So
yeah,
I think people, we got into this lull of like up only, wow, it's going to be $500 million of Bitcoin inflows every day and it's going to go up 3% daily, to a little bit of shock from that, which it's obviously not going to do that forever. The run rate numbers would have been insane. But, you know, when there wasn't an ETF and Bitcoin went to 70 and down to 50, you know, 30 and up to 70 again, you know, those were outflows. I mean, that's what selling is. Like, people are getting so wrapped around the axle, like, oh my God, these ETF outflows. Like, yeah, that's what selling is. And that's why the price went down. And that would have happened without ETFs. Like, it didn't do anything different. So and there's zero world in my mind where ETF buyers could be more fickle or short-term oriented than crypto natives who participate in this all day long. So if anything, you're getting stickier capital, even if it's this, the tiniest amount stickier. And I just think like it's this classic, like you said, the cycle behavior where, oh my God, we're so back. Oh my God, it's so over. So I think just people can zoom out a bit and you know, look at a 1 year, 5 year chart.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, these 20 to 30% pullbacks are healthy, expected. You know, you get 5 or 6 of them every bull cycle. So yeah, I think it's a little bit of a nothing burger, but Matt Hogan, who spoke at DAS this week, made a good point about this though. You know, cause we've been speculating about who's been buying these, you know, did an episode with Jim Bianco and Eric Balcunas the other day about where are these flows coming from. And Matt made this point about, you know, there are basically like two pools of capital that are really, especially in like the wealth management side that can buy this. There's like the self-directeds, right? So like you basically putting this in your IRA or whatever. And then there are the RIAs. And the RIAs, like the way the distribution works is there are these things called wirehouses, right? Which, you know, like Morgan Stanley, et cetera, that they like roll this out to these massive networks of RIAs across the US. And like that process hasn't really happened yet, which is why, I don't know, I think some of this argument about that like Jim has been making, and I do think Jim is right that outflows can happen and that there probably is some merit to the idea that it's not this like passive structural RIA bid that we've been talking about forever, but that's also coming. And the estimate that a bunch of people gave this week is that basically like maybe like 20% of the buying has happened, but there's still the vast majority of it has yet to come. So yeah, I think we're going to get, actually, you know, last point, this, the GBTC numbers are just funny to me. Like they, if you look at the net outflows in terms of GBTC, it's at 13 some billion today, but if you look at that AUM of GBTC, it's basically flat.
Yeah.
It's just funny, you know, how that works. I think ultimately that's going to end up being a pretty savvy strategy for them to keep their fees where they kept it.
Yeah, I think that first, they probably knew going in that first wave of outflows on launch was already going to happen. And then we saw them slow. And then we've seen them kind of pick back up again. And then you had them issue that filing for that new micro mini ETF or whatever, which was, they're saying that's the HODL long-term passive. And it's really low fees competitive with the others. And then they're saying GBTC is going to be their trading instrument because it's much more liquid, much higher AUM, and the fees are going to stay the same. So I just don't see how, like, what are we at? Like 50% or something of the total Bitcoin holdings are gone. It's a large number. Obviously, as you mentioned, dollar value, that's very significant relative to what it was 3-6 months ago. But it's not like every GBTC holder is gone. Like, come on. So it's easy to get, you know, super bearish at these times when flows pick up, and you know, super bullish, invincible when they're high.
Totally. Should we talk a little bit about the SEC's campaign to make ETH a security?
Yeah, that's I don't know what I mean. My base case is that the ETH ETF isn't going to happen. I think, or it is going to happen eventually, but I think it's probably not May approval. We'll see. That if you look at when the SEC started engaging with Bitcoin ETF issuers, it wasn't more than 2 months ahead. And if May's the number, you know, we're approaching 2 months because it's late May. So, you know, it was more like closer to 1 month where they really started getting busy. So I think it's not all bad news quite yet, you know, you have some signs here that I think they're trying to do everything they can. We know Gensler basically works for Warren, and you know, she's probably seen the uptick in Bitcoin momentum as not a great thing for her, you know, as she digs her heels in against the asset class. So these things matter come election time, and it just seems like they're going to do every delay and stall tactic. Ultimately, get taken to court probably again. Maybe we get it late this year, early next. But yeah, the latest development with the Ethereum Foundation is quite interesting.
So, what's your impression on the impact that this like mounting track record of losses has on the credibility of the SEC? You know, they lost to Ripple with XRP. Looks like they're going to lose with Coinbase. They've been just pretty staunchly and expressly against the Bitcoin ETFs for as long as they have been. And at what point do you just kind of start to look a little bit silly and like you're fighting a losing battle and the tide is clearly turned and you're still in some kind of denial about it? And I guess, what is the Steelman argument for why the courts wouldn't do for ETH what they did for Bitcoin and just essentially force Gary Gensler's hand into approving this? I'm sort of scratching my head and trying to understand the strategy here, because at one point, you know, I didn't like it, but it was certainly a viable strategy, what they were attempting. And it looks like the judicial branch of the government has not supported the SEC's territory here. Not to mention also, there's a great thread by Brian Quintenz, who's now at A16Z, previously chair of the CFTC. And you know, he makes this point that when the SEC allowed ETH futures ETFs to trade on its regulated security exchanges, it explicitly acknowledged the status of underlying ETH as being not a security and outside of its jurisdiction. So again, they're also, in addition to this like weird head scratching, digging their heels in and a lost cause that I think is going to impact their credibility as an agency, there's also this turf war that's going on with the CFTC that folks can't be happy about. So I'm trying not to be too biased, but I just don't really understand. I'm confused.
Yeah, it's funny when you see some of the public officials like Powell get so much crap for his vagueness or his, you know, lack or transparency, whatever. But when you compare like some people and their communications like his to Gensler's, it's like he's an absolute saint. Gensler is purposefully very misleading and zero transparency and can't believe a single word he says, right? And you almost feel like it's very, very politically motivated. And there's been a number of things that have led people on both aisles. I mean, Scaramucci was at DAS this week. You know, he's kind of become a very staunch Democrat in this election. And even he's like, admits all these things. So I would have thought that they would show some reprieve. I thought that they would view these losses as damaging, but I guess, you know, I guess not. Like, I think if ultimately he has political aspirations and he's already kicked to the curb by one party, he's already damaged by one party, you know, he you look at these incentives and he's got to make up for it in some way, I guess. And it's shocking, but yeah, he's got his own agenda and no one really knows what's going to happen at this point. I hear both sides all day long. But a lot of the lawyers are even quite confused and lawyers that aren't crypto native, like I love Bitcoin, I love ETH lawyers. So who knows? We'll see. I think ultimately, as you mentioned, that momentum is in the right direction. But these mini events, it's tough to predict. I think on that part, one that went under the radar was this Coinbase derivatives filing for a couple other coins, Doge, BCH, LTC, which I don't really know what that means broadly. Like everyone's extrapolating like, oh, every coin's going to become a CFTC regulated future and that's going to be their path to an ETF. And I don't think that's the case, but I do think there must be some validity or reason that Coinbase is doing this, and they're not stupid. So they're not trying to pick battles while they're fighting the SEC with another regulator and damage their business. So that's positive. And, you know, I don't think anyone really cares that much about those three coins they listed, but again, another step in the right direction on some sort of clarity. And, you know, they've been having success with their rollout of the futures plus international. I don't know if you've seen those international volumes lately. They're absolutely roofing up to like 6 billion a day from less than a billion like a month ago. So they're doing something right over there.
They're doing quite a bit right. I've got a prediction for you actually on maybe a little bit less to do with the Coinbase front, but I think it's going to get pretty weird actually with some of the new ETFs that are going to get approved. Not this year, but within the next 3 years. And I think that there's definitely going to be an ETH ETF. I don't know how this battle from the SEC is ultimately going to end up playing out. I don't really see them, you know, knock on wood, but I don't really see them making much headway there. It looks like they're going to, you know, get dragged kicking and screaming into approving this ETF like they did the last one. But I think the incentive after that is, now, I am starting to see some odd takes. This is just, I don't know, I'm going to go on a bit of a rant here, but one of my least favorite corners of all of crypto is the Bitcoin people who are like, ETH security, the government shouldn't allow an ETF. I hate that. Like, that is nails on a chalkboard for me. But you do see it a little bit. There is a little bit of denial in the ETH camp that, you know, you hear this too. It's like, oh, well, they're going to stop at ETH. Like, they're not stopping at ETH. Are you kidding me? Like, think about the incentives from the BlackRock perspective. This is how they make their living, right? Like, they're an asset manager. They're going to give you and a menu of assets. They're not going to be opinionated. And critically, they're not going to have your crypto native sensitivities, right? They're not going to be like, oh yeah, Bitcoin, ETH, Solana. No, they don't know. They're going to give you Doge. They're going to give you XRP. They're going to give you Litecoin. And for evidence, I'm just going to direct you to the Bloomberg terminal, where when you look at the list of crypto assets, it's like a time portal going back to 2017, because it's like Bitcoin, ETH, Litecoin, Stellar, XRP. You know, those are the ETFs that we're going to get. I'm going to give you that prediction right now. It's not going to be the ones that like are cool and in the know and all the crypto people want. Those are the ETFs that we're going to get after this, in my opinion. So that's my old prediction.
It's the same incentives as an exchange. Like, I don't want to run a crypto exchange and have two tokens listed. Like, I want to list every possible token under the sun. You don't go to like your brokerage account and you know, Interactive Brokers is like, we think Robinhood's a bad company. We're not going to list them. No, you list everything because when you run the casino, you want to make sure everybody can participate. So absolutely. I mean, if there's demand for anything, we're going to tokenize it and we're going to put it on the blockchain, or we're going to wrap it in ETF and give it to traditional guys. Like, that's, I think people just get lost in the sauce a little bit here. You know, either where their ideals sit or, you know, the biases and things, but you're totally right. I mean, all of these things are just really positive steps on a zoomed out multi-year time horizon for the industry under a regulatory point of view.
Yeah. Now, there is some infrastructure that needs to happen, right? You need a futures market for these things, all that type of stuff. But I just think that all you have to do is look at the incentives, and the exchange comparison is exactly right. Like, that's why Coinbase is listing Doge. It's like, that's where the volume is, you know?
Yeah.
That's where
the volume is. BlackRock's are going to have like a little more of a filter. Like, they have different, much bigger existing businesses that they have to preserve reputation on. So I don't see going too crazy at the gates, but yeah, clearly Coinbase is laying the groundwork with these futures markets, knowing what needs to be done.
I agree. So what do you think ends up happening to, you mentioned that you think Trump is going to win. That was the last thing that ended up coming up quite a bit at DAS, actually. The US election has massive implications for markets. I would have to imagine that a Trump presidency is bullish for the stock market, bullish for crypto. Trump does have his Polygon NFTs, which is just hilarious. But what ends up happening to Gensler? Does he just get, I'd have to imagine that he gets the boot if Trump moves.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's gone. Yeah, they're all gone. I mean, it's a complete, like, he would come in with maybe even a bigger stick than he came in last time and just clean house, but like with a vengeance, right? All these people, you know, he had a point to prove when he came in office the first time. And I would say that point is probably multiplied the amount of, you know, what we've seen happen after. So absolutely, they're gone. If he wins, right? Like, not, I don't actually usually care too much about politics and get involved. I also was a little bummed to see how consensus, maybe that was just the crypto community speaking their wishes, that Trump would likely win. Normally when people are very consensus, you know, I don't like that when people agree with me. Yeah. So I was a little annoyed that so many people thought he was going to win. But yeah, who knows what to think? We have a long ways to go. You know, we have, there's a lot that can happen, but there's very little question. I mean, look at Brian, right? He, you know, has government roots, agencies, and he's defending the industry. Like, I don't know how many more SEC and CFTC defectors it takes to go join private practice and be fighting for crypto companies, right? To make it just so obvious that getting rid of this Warren Gensler combo would be resoundingly positive.
What do you think about that? I saw, so for folks who haven't been following this as much, there's been an exodus from the SEC in terms of their crypto enforcement division. And a lot of these former SEC professionals are actually moving to crypto companies and essentially helping them as like an in-house counsel type thing. And on the one hand, that's probably the best move available to you to navigate dealing with the SEC. On the other hand, it rubs people the wrong way. And I do understand why. It's kind of this is like the BitLicense that happened with Ben Lawsky, and never interacted with Ben. I don't know him at all, but you know, they basically put the most draconian, you know, unfriendly regulation in the state of New York possible. And then he quits after writing that piece of legislation and then charges companies $30 million to help them get a license. I mean, come on. I mean, if that's not extortion, it's not 30 million. It's extremely expensive and arduous, as evidenced by the extremely small list of companies that have gotten a BitLicense. And they didn't even give the licenses out for the first couple of years. So yeah, I mean, how does that, you define grift and then tell me how this doesn't fit that definition. So well,
yeah, I don't know the detail. Like, that's a case that's maybe a little more nuanced, and you probably have points there. I don't follow it any closely other than the numbers and the headlines. And to me, it's just, well, these are people who are smart. They are successful, that got into good jobs, and assuming those are good jobs. And they're now dug into crypto and realizing, like, holy cow, there's huge benefits to this technology. It's way better than a bunch of things we're regulating on the TradFi side. And they just got really, really smart about it, because they dug in and learned every detail there is to know when fighting this case, and realized they're not going to get, you know, when they're pushing Gensler and Warren's agenda, there's nothing for them to benefit. They're just like minions who are, you know, at the bottom of the totem pole and advancing this agenda they probably don't believe in. And they're going to go where the money is. They're going to go where the future career potential is. And that's how I read it. I think all these cases, I mean, you're seeing this in the circuit courts, right? All the SEC is not let up, and we're talking about them doubling down, which is a little weird, but the courts are like, now everybody in the circuit court, they've appealed 10 cases. They all know crypto, and they're all like, why is this so bad? It's not bad at all. And that's where we're seeing these wins. So in a way, it's a very educating and positive long-term, because people are seeing the benefits of it and getting the inside scoop on the technology. So I that's more how I read it, is just, if you're a young person or you want a career in 20 years, do you want to align with a 1933 Securities Act, or you want to go align yourself with the technology that's growing quicker than ever?
Totally. I didn't mean to. I was more talking a little bit about the BitLicense.
Yeah, there,
but,
yeah.
But I do. I agree with you that.
Well, that's a case where he probably got his pockets padded by, you know, millions and millions of dollars by traditional finance in New York. It's like the hotels, right, and the taxi cabs. It's all controlled by incumbents, and so he was probably getting funded in one way or another. And when the spoon that feeds you changes, then you change. But yeah, it's interesting.
It definitely is a net benefit, I think, for crypto companies to be able to navigate this stuff. I do understand. I don't know. I understand all sides of it, right? You need regulators. I'm not one of these crazy free market maximalists. Like, I think that those people could be a little bit frustrating. I think you should optimize. You should do as much as you can to make it as free as you can. But you know, you need regulators. But it does. I understand why it rubs people the wrong way, where it's like these people get to write the regulation and then essentially get paid to help you navigate it. I mean, I understand why that also rubs people the wrong way, right? So
it kind of reminds me of the whole inflation, no inflation, Fed, Treasury, money printing, not money printing, government deficits, these debates. And I think it's very simplistic, but I think if you just zoom out and you say, okay, if you were in Yellen and Powell's shoes, what do you want? You want one, a good, they want legacy and power. Okay, what's that mean? That means a strong economy, happy people, rich people. Okay, how do I get that? Well, I keep things easy. I make sure inflation doesn't get out of hand, so then we don't have to tighten too quick. And we keep a base level line of inflation. So everybody knows we have a huge debt burden. The only way to get out is if we have this inflation and we print more money and the economy grows its way out and we devalue the currency. But imagine if they just came out and said, yeah, we know the debt burdens aren't sustainable, fiscal is running way too hot, and we need to devalue, you know, the dollar needs to devalue over the next 5 years. I mean, that would send things in shambles. So they're going to just, you know, mouthpiece and do the best they can to kind of like manage it there. And I kind of view like the regulations the same way. Like people know where it's going. Everybody knows the direction this is heading. And crypto isn't funding politicians in the same way traditional finance is, right? All these people are leaving the office and getting paid $10 million to go speak at Goldman Sachs and others. And it's just incentives. These people are, over time, they know where it's going. And so it just takes longer to get there.
I agree with that. And I've said before that if I were in Chair Powell's or Yellen's position, I'm not even really confident I would do much different from what they're doing. Like they kind of, I don't know. I guess a couple of different viewpoints on this is that they've actually threaded the needle extremely well, and they've been dealt a very tricky hand to deal with, to frankly manage in the last couple of years, and they've done a pretty good job. It looks like we got our soft landing or no landing or whatever. I mean, that's, no one was calling for or predicting that. So you got to give them props. On the other hand, I'm also sympathetic to the view that, well, yeah, you can manage that. All you have to do is run a $7 trillion deficit. I'm not really sure where I ultimately end up shaking out. It's a tough thing. I'm glad I don't have to deal with it. But
wherever we make the most money, that's where we shake out.
Yeah. Well, I think crypto is the beneficiary here for sure. And honestly, the argument that's always just sat with me there is, you know, all these people that still question Bitcoin and ETH and crypto writ large, young people don't question this at all. And so maybe it takes some period of time, but I don't know. That is the real tailwind, I think, to understand, is that more young people are going to want to put their money in these types of assets than the old, you know, boomer Ponzi of bonds.
That's just the way. What I've actually been interested in is how many of these macro and traditional, like, people I follow in podcasts are have been talking about Bitcoin more in a positive way as a piece of the portfolio. And I don't remember it being like that. I read a Goldman Sachs note this week that from their trading desk about, they even said, you know, Bitcoin's been strong, ETF flow is positive, but they just don't feel like it's euphoric like it was in 2021. They don't feel the same craze or unabated, just like, you know, belief in it anymore. And that's really positive. I think, and anecdotally, some of these more traditional people that I pay close attention to and follow, they're talking about it in their portfolio, 1-2%. And a couple of them are like, yeah, actually I've owned way too many small caps this year. My portfolio's lagged NVIDIA, but I had 2-5% Bitcoin, and that's made me outperform. So people are looking at this and seeing it as a viable asset. I think it's one of those things like the Lindy effect, just the longer it goes and trades as it should trade, right? As a debasement hedge, when the printers go on, it goes up, the more it adds legitimacy. And I think crypto natives maybe also here get a little too wrapped around the axle in these short-term price moves and can get caught up in what's going on Twitter. And more and more we're converging with the traditional financial system, and it's not just the ancestral crypto Twitter stuff. So I think zooming out here is good, and everything points in a positive, you know, secular trend for the industry.
I agree with that. Totally agree. Well, buddy, this was a fun one. It's good to see you this week. And Tyler, we hope wherever you are, you're most likely very hungover, but also hopefully having a fun time. You deserve it. So
absolutely. Two straight weeks we got to hang out in person. So
I know, man.
Gonna miss that.
Good. Me too.
We'll do it again soon.
Are you back in Miami right now?
Yep. Yeah. It started raining when I landed, but we'll be good. Get some sun beach this weekend.
It's raining here in London too, but I understand it basically does that all the time. So that's yeah,
exactly. Nothing. It's normal.
Nothing.
Cool.
All right, partner.
Safe travels back.
Thanks, dude. See you same time next week.
Take care.